This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters series. Sophie Cunningham is a non-fiction writer, a novelist, an editor, a teacher and mentor, and so much more. She is the author of 7 books, with more to come, and is a member of the Order of Australia for her contributions to literature. She was a co-founder of the Stella Prize, former editor of Mianjin, former chair of the Literature Board of the Australia Council for the Arts, and she now sits on the board of the University of Queensland Press and the Australian Society of Authors. She's written for a range of magazines, including the Griffith Review and The Monthly. Sophie's latest books are her picture book, Flipper and Finnegan, The True Story of Penguins in Tiny Jumpers, and her new novel, This Devastating Fever, which we discuss in this wide-ranging conversation about writing, editing, trees, climate change, voice, and lots more. I do hope you enjoy. Sophie Cunningham, it is my absolute joy to be speaking with you today. Welcome to the podcast.
I'm very pleased to be here.
Sophie, there's so much to ask you about, and I've got like books piled up around me and have been deep in the archive of looking at things you've written. But I'm going to try and keep it to a reasonable time. So I want to begin by asking, what's the first thing that you remember writing?
I think up front it's important to say that I'm turning 60 next year, so that you're asking about the actual olden days. You're asking about like 1966 or something, 67.
Tell us about the olden days, Sophie.
So they were more fun. That's my vague memory. But my memories are vague, so I can remember I used to write little novels and books and things, but not actually quite as obsessively as some people I know, but I cannot remember the detail. I did keep a diary for some years, a terrible, terrible diary, because I had no life experience to write of, but I would earnestly write it. And one of the bits I can, no, I keep it because it has got these lovely little historical snippets. My favourite one is when I said, "Today the Prime Minister of Australia got sacked. Mum and Dad say it's a crime against democracy. I smoked an Alpine cigarette." That's the bit, pretty well the only bit of my diary I can remember. So it kind of works despite the fact it's, you know, I constantly would swing, in fact, which I probably have done in all my writing ever since, between, you know, some astute historical observations and then talking about me and sort of totally weird and particular details.
I love that. Actually, I want to ask you about that because people have commented on that about your writing as we go forward. Okay, so you're writing little novels, you're writing in your journal. How were books and story and art perhaps fueling your early life, your teenage life?
I was always a huge reader, but young adult fiction, as we think of it now, didn't exactly exist. So I read all the Ian Blytons, all the E.S. Nesbitt. And E.S. Nesbitt's really weird kind of gothic stuff, like, as much as I can remember it, you know, Tolkien. So I read lots of those kind of books, which, and what Katie did, I actually loved. But the heroine, who was Katie, did in fact, you know, break her back. There was a lot of punishment of the heroines in a lot of the books that I read. And then, so then I got a bit sick of that and I moved on to all the James Bond series, and I got obsessed with escape books. Like, you know, it's like, you can think of the, it's like the movies, but a lot of those movies were based on, you know, real testimonial novels about, you know, escaping from various, you know, prison camps during World War II. I had a real phase of that. So I would get, and there was a Catherine Cookson romances. My grandmother used to lend me, you know, give me those, and she had them on. I loved those. All the Poldark books, I was obsessed with Poldark. This is when I got slightly older. I did love a saucy, slightly saucy book as a teenager. And when I would babysit at about 14, and this is the 70s by now, I would raid the bookshelf of the various parents and find, you know, the story of J and O and various 70s. Well, they were, these books weren't necessarily written in the 70s, but the various erotica that everyone, it was de rigueur to have on your bookshelf. So I did love a a rude book.
Did you plan your babysitting? Yes, absolutely.
My first novel shows some of that. I actually had read so many of those books when I was meant to be looking after the children. Yes, when I was a child myself. Anyway, no, I didn't plan my babysitting around it because I really, in Melbourne, in Lefty, not Lefty, but whatever you want to call it, Hawthorne back in the day, it was you were just were in no doubt that you would find something on the bookshelves.
I love that. I feel like that's the second chapter of your memoir about all the books that you were finding.
Middle class Melbourne, yeah.
Sophie, you and I have made a habit of having a good gossip over festival drinks, which is obviously a favourite pastime of mine. And the last time we did this, among other things that we won't discuss, you revealed to me that you'd edited Winton in your early days as an editor. So I wanted to use that as a jumping in point to hear about that first kind of phase of yourself, as I see it, in the literary industry, which is coming in as editor and then on to publisher. Is that right? Have I got the timeline right?
Yes, you have. I copy edited Cloud Street. I wasn't senior enough to be doing the kind of big picture editing at that point. I was very lucky to start at a McPhee Gribble, which I've talked about a bit. It was an independent enough. I'd been there a couple of years. It was absorbed into Penguin for various complex reasons. A lot to do with the interest rates, actually. They're massively, right, you know, the interest rates went up to 18% or something. And so, but because I was at such a fine publishing house, it meant that I was, my first editing experiences were with really terrific authors. And because my bosses were great, Hilary McPhee and Diana Gribble, I was given a lot of encouragement to kind of follow my instinct. And I had quite a strong instinct because I had just been such a massive reader. I had an arts degree. I'd done the English literature and film degree as well. But and so it meant that I was very early on, I was like proofreading and sometimes copy editing people like Tim Winton, like Priscilla Majeska, like Helen Garner. One of the first books I remember really feeling like I had an impact on, the author might have another view, of course, but became really aware that I had some kind of input into the shape, was Kerry Greenwood's the first of the Franny Fisher books, Cocaine Blues.
Wow.
And so basically being privy to the whole kind of writing process was an extraordinary experience. And Play with Cloud Street, that was a different kind of experience because really Tim's such a, that was several books in, four or five books in. So he was such a fine craftsman. I didn't really have to do a lot. I mean, I had to do a lot in terms of being a production editor and technical stuff and whatever. It was really very polished, but I learned so much about voice and bravery and the kind of way he experimented with language. It was kind of it was a pretty important book for me as a writer. I mean, I've always found it quite an inspirational book to have worked on. So I was just lucky that I had really amazing experiences when I was really very young. And certainly Tim Winton's work was part of that, but not, and it wasn't necessarily though the big name writers either, just being people who were sort of generous and enjoyed the fact that I cared about their work and would have lots of chats. And it was just sort of like, you know, pretty amazing school of life stuff, I suppose.
When you think about that period of time that you were with McPhee Gribble and when you went in and kind of when you came out, what are the types of lessons, I suppose, or editing rules that you took from that experience that you can kind of name as having learned through that experience?
Yeah, that's a good question. My answer to that question is a voice. So when my first job was dealing with the unsolicited pile, which is a fantastic experience because you might be spending a day. I wasn't a full-time employee at this point. This is how I started at McPhee Gribble, sort of sitting surrounded by manuscripts and probably a bit like judging books, you know, you're kind of looking at them. And one thing was how quickly I felt I could tell whether something was grabbing me. And the books that did grab me that I would then read all of, in a way, I wouldn't ever write the report on those books until 2 or 3 days later because I wanted to see what stayed with me. And that's still basically how I read. Some books stay with me, some I forget. Even if I'm enjoying them, I forget them quite quickly. I feel the same actually with film. that kind of, does this book have something original, something that's grabbing you? And I think voice, as a writer, voice is something I've worked really hard to try and develop, and I don't think I had a very strong voice in my early work, and I think my voice is getting better, and that's been a very, you know, it's what I read for, and it's what I sort of aspire to as a writer.
Were there things that you witnessed or experienced in the editor-author relationship and way of working that you brought forward into the way that you continue to work, or that you realised you definitely never wanted to be involved with again?
Both. Yes and no. I mean, Hillary was an inspirational person to watch working, and one of the things she taught me was to trust my instinct, and to kind of say, when I was editing, to kind of keep track of every time I tripped up. And I remember saying to her, but I don't, you know, I'm young, I don't really know what I'm doing yet. And she said, you might be wrong, but unless you actually trust your instinct and then go back and try and work out what the issue is, you don't have any tools to do this job. Yeah, you know, that is the tool of an editor, is to be a kind of intelligent, curious, questioning reader. And the fact that she took such care to train me, and she also worked very closely with authors, and there was a kind of engagement with the development of literary works that doesn't really, seems to be less available to writers now. And that's the couple of reasons. One is some writers really resist it and resent it, and the other is that there's not often, publishing houses, not a budget. So if someone who is a really good editor is told that they're going to get $900 or $1,500 to do an edit on a book, there's going to be a real limit to how much they can push that, unless they do it in their own time. I've been very lucky with editors, and because I've published a lot of my books with text, even though I've been, I do kids' books with Alan Unwin, and I've worked with a range of people, and I have had fairly attentive editing, but I do know that a lot of authors do complain, and I understand why, that they're not, that kind of time and investment in seeing it as a relationship, that we're kind of working together to produce a work, and I think that can be pretty extraordinary experience. But also, I think as an editor, you also have to know that it's not about you. So it's about getting the balance between helping. It's like being a midwife, and it's they're very feminized kind of languages are often used around editing, and that can be slightly weird, and if you have an ego, that can sometimes be very can be a bit hard to take. So some personalities just think, I'm sick of not being thanked adequately or whatever, and I understand. Look, I mean, I'm probably sometimes had problems with that as well, but then other times people were incredibly generous with their praise and with their time, and knew that I was learning my craft, so there was a sense of relationship. That said, in terms of what I learned not to do, it's sometimes you do have to remember that these are professional relationships, and you're not best friends, you're in a professional relationship, and I do think that you kind of do need boundaries as an editor or publisher. Because otherwise it can be hard to kind of stand your ground or have the kind of professional conversations you sometimes need to have, not just about editing, but about whether you like the cover or whether you think the publicity is good enough or whatever. Like, it's not just, and there's so much focus on whether your book is edited well, as there should be, but there's so much to publishing which isn't just about that part of the process. So I probably, having developed my skills in that very generous work environment, have probably become a little bit more of a hard ass about, it is a job, these are professional relationships. And, you know, I don't know that Hillary and I would have agreed with how my thinking's evolved on that.
I want to move on to your experience of publishing your first novel, Geography, which you mentioned before, and which I know is out of print, but I found a copy in my amazing local op shop years ago, so I feel very lucky to have this one.
It's hopefully going to go back in print, by the way, but anyway, we'll see.
That is
not definite,
brilliant.
Yes, it is not definite, but I'm keen to it. I want there to be an e-book. I don't, you know, even if there's not a physical. That book came, the first draft, which was only about 18,000 words, it actually came in a rush in about 6 weeks. So, no, I hadn't been writing it for ages. I'd wanted my whole life to be a writer. I'd done writing classes, and then because I ended up in this amazing job, I ended up thinking, I don't need to be a writer. I'm just having a great time and working with books. And I stopped thinking about being a writer for a while. And then I do actually remember a moment where a really fantastic author, someone I worked with for years, who I really liked, really adored, said, I've just got the Paris Studio or something like that. And I just was so filled with bitterness and envy. And I just thought, oh, dear, I think this in my head, I crossed some kind of line where I wanted to be a writer, partly because of the writer's life and the freedom. There are many things that are awful about being a writer. However, there are some really amazing things about being a writer. And I just thought, I realised I wanted that life more than I wanted the life I had. And also being a publisher is very demanding in terms of hours and how much of yourself you give. And I was running out of puff. And so I went part-time. And geography came in a real rush, and then then I had to draft and redraft and those kind of things, but it still didn't take that long. I think the whole process was probably only got a year or 18 months, but no, it wasn't something I'd been, but I was interested in those kind of Anais Nin, that kind of French erotica, Marguerite Duras, Jean Rhys, like Wives of Gaslit Sea, this kind of and texts which interrogate, I don't know whether one is object or subject, and kind of losing a sense of self and boundaries, and all those things were of interest to me as a writer. And of course I'd had some disastrous love affair which also was fuel for it. But the actual broader intellectual interest in writing that this subject wasn't just a personal impulse.
How did you navigate that, you've got that kind of strong desire then to be the writer? What was it like when you published and you were on the other side of the publishing kind of machine and out there talking about the book and being the author?
With geography, I had I've always loved this devastating theme. My latest book has come out with Ultimate Press, but most of my books have come out with text, and I've always had a fantastic time working with text, and as I did with geography. There was a bidding war. It's just about the idea. Often it's the first books where that happens, really, before people quite know whether it's you're worth the money. Anyway, so that was all very exciting. I chose to go with text, and they were really great to work with. But what was the real shock was having to talk about the book in public. I found really traumatic. And while I'd done a lot of public speaking because of my work as a publisher, it's very different when it's your own work. And I very quickly learned that while that book is not all autobiographical, A, people assumed it was, and B, some bits of it were. And I just thought, I'm never going to make myself that vulnerable again. I just found it kind of quite traumatic. Because one of the things I did to make one of the things, choices I made was that the character, Catherine, was much crazier than I have ever been. Well, I'd like to think she was anyway. I did that to push the narrative into kind of melodrama. It was all kind of more excessive than, my own experiences were with a failed love affair. So you kind of push everything into extremes, and then it's actually quite distressing when interviewers say, oh, so obviously, I actually got asked if I was a bunny boiler when I was promoting the book in the UK, because Fatal Attraction had just come out, and I was just, oh shit, this is, and also it stops you enjoying the process as much. And this is something I say to my writing students: it's always fine. It can be really important to write from life and to use life. And I mean, clearly, I still do it a little bit in some kind of, but in a much more performative way in my recent books. But that kind of, there's something a bit unguarded and unprotected about geography, which I would never, never do again.
That's so interesting. And I wanted to talk more about this, partly because I'll tell the listeners, I did actually message you yesterday and said, Sophie, seriously, there's like 2 days worth of interview material here. I don't even know where to begin with you. I've got so many questions to ask. And so I asked you, what do you want to talk about? What is the material that you don't often get to talk about? And in fact, I wanted to make this link, and you mentioned there about the fact that some of this stuff you write about in This Devastating Fever, your new book, in a much more performative way. And the scene that had me laughing out loud again yesterday for the second time when I read it is the scene where the author, Alice, in the book is meeting with, is it her agent, Sarah, or a publisher?
Are you talking about when the pillow situation?
No, this
when
the pillows collapse under this is a Tiamat. Right,
no, that's fictional. That is fictional. Because the agent, actually, I'm going to mention, sorry, I've cut you off, but the agent, people love that character. The agent really is fictional, I promise, hand in heart. However, she is really, but I felt like I knew her. Do you know what I mean? Those scenes came so easily. And she's a kind of, I put all, you know, due respect to some of the people I'll be listing, people I've worked with, Jenny Darling, Jane Novak, Hilary McPhee, Diana Gribble, Barbara Mobbs, you know, any number of extraordinary women I've worked with in the industry, and I put them in a blender, basically, and I just kind of, she just sort of emerged. So I was never, because, I mean, I had never written a book which had footnotes and that the arguments about footnotes. My therapist is in there as well. So basically the kind of direct speaking, I've never had anyone speak to me quite as rudely as Sarah speaks to Alice, to be honest, but my therapist has occasionally. So
I love the character. And as you say, it feels like a character who has stepped out of real life, because those scenes, particularly about the industry itself, the scene that I'm talking about at Tiamo's is where she says, explain to me why there's not more sex in this novel. And considering we were just talking about geography, she goes on to say, you brought a great deal of enthusiasm to the genre. Sex sold your first book. You know, my job is to sell your book. It's such a funny scene. It goes on, you know, eventually that Alice goes to be comforted by her writing friends at the pub, which, you know, if listeners listening have not yet had the experience of in some way being traumatized by a publisher or editor, they will at some stage when they are published. So I feel like people can really relate to it. But as we were saying, it irritates you when people draw that conclusion that that is you and that is the agent and this is from your real life. And I had the same conversation with Christos recently about 7.5. So, you know, why is this so frustrating? How can you frame what is the author and the role of creating fiction?
It is very complicated. And I mean, because I actually was having this conversation with a friend who works in publishing, and they said, well, you kind of asked for it, Sophie, which is a perfectly reasonable thing to say. And I've heard Helen Garner talk about this, and she and I find it very interesting the way she talks about it as well. She says, so with Mikey Grip, it just is all true. In geography, it is not all true. However, there, you know, I'm sort of arguing, you know, fine detail. So it's like, it's not really. But over with my fiction and nonfiction, people always say, oh, it's clearly you. And quite often that is just not true. I know myself. I exaggerate aspects of myself. I use my voice. It's strategic. So in Melbourne, the book I wrote, Sophie, the author of the book, walks Melbourne and kind of the kind of narrative, you're coming on a walk with Sophie, and she's going to talk to you about the things that she loves about this city. I mean, that was a structural decision. Mm. I mean, I do walk around Melbourne, but, you know, I did that. I was using it as a way of kind of working with the reader. And with This Devastating Fever, I did have a version of the author, or called the author, who was quite fictional. But I've written, the book took 16 years. I've written endless drafts. I was having trouble making it work. And during the pandemic, I did just kind of think, fuck it. I'm just going to just going to finish it. And I'm not even going to kind of particularly edit myself. And the first scene with the agent where you set up, these are the things I'm not going to talk about. That was me really trying to say to the reader, this is not me. Mm. This is not a book about my bisexuality, for example. I do, you know, Alice, the character, is bisexual. That's partly because I'm interested in queer history. Bloomsbury people are queer, so I kind of made the gesture. But saying that one is bisexual is in no way some kind of amazing, intimate exploration of one's bisexuality. I've had people ask me, is this a book about my father's It is not a book. I've written about my father's. It is not a book about my father's. As I said, I'm almost 60. I've been married for 20 years. Your kind of family of origin is feels very important and interesting when you're in your 20s and even 30s and you get to a certain age and you've got your own family, however you define family, be it friends or pets or, you know, family one, whatever. You things change. And so, but I was very aware of using Alice's kind of the stuff in this devastating fever that is true, inverted commas, is that I went to all the libraries and I went to Sri Lanka. So the kind of research journey was the part of myself that I was more than happy to share with the reader, partly because it helped me structure. I like the idea of the author as, you know, author as adventurer, even if it's adventures of the mind. So it was kind of a bit like the walking in the Melbourne book. It was a way of kind of creating a journey for a narrator that kind of helps, that engages with the themes of the historical section of the novel and takes the people through. Yes, the author swears like me, that Alice, the author, swears a lot. I swear a lot. People are sometimes actually, so a couple of people said to me, oh, your book's quite funny. I was like, yes, thank you. It is, you seem surprised. Like I'm slightly put out by the fact that people find that surprising. But, you know, I don't talk to ghosts. I'm not married to a librarian. And yes, the character Alice has a female partner, but there are more than one, you know, one can write fictional women as partners, even if one actually also has a non-fictional woman as a partner, like a real, you know, like it's not.
Yeah.
How do I connect with the reader? How do I amplify the themes? You're kind of slave to the book. What is going to make the best story? What bits of myself is it useful to use? Like it's kind of, it's not, it doesn't feel personal. Geography did feel personal and there was not control and I hadn't thought all this stuff through.
Do you think that it's an age-old obsession of readers to find the real, the true in a book, or do you think that it has increasingly become part of this kind of, you know, selling of the author as part of the publishing package in the book?
Yeah, I think that's part of it, definitely. It's possibly always been, I must admit, I don't really know enough about the history of how these kind of books have been marketed. The reason why it annoys me, apart from the vulnerability issue, is apart from the fact it's just awkward, is that it's very reductive. Like what, instead of talking to someone about the ideas in your book or what excites you about the book or the pleasures of writing the book, you end up saying, that happened, that didn't, that happened, that, it's like, whatever. And I also think it's age. Like when I was younger, I would read books wanting to know that. Whereas now I don't really care what I want to know is, am I swept up in the voice of this book? Good. If I'm not, I might think, oh, did this really happen? I wonder. Well, you kind of distract yourself. It almost to me is a sign that the person hasn't engaged fully just with the narrative and the pleasures of reading the book. Because they're trying to find something else interesting, just the what did or didn't happen, and it kind of is incredibly reductive. I also have been wondering if it's partly because we're in a very particular time when it comes to just thinking about identity politics. And so I do think that there can be, you know, you want to be very clear that you're not appropriating other people's stories, or you know, so not everyone feels that need, but when one is trying to navigate those kind of issues at this really complicated time, I thought that it was very a good idea for me to keep a narrator who was close to home, you know, that was kind of a woman who is about my age, of my class, of my skin colour, with my kind of cultural background, so that I could just not get. I did have a version where I had a contemporary Sri Lankan character of the book, and people felt that I just really hadn't managed to make that work. And that always made me a bit sad, partly because the book is much whiter than I wanted it to be, particularly given I'm writing partly about Ceylon, Sri Lanka. So you end up writing closer to yourself in a kind of geographic sense almost, I think. But that said, there's always been a history of these kind of, you know, people using their real life. I'd be interested to know what Christos had to say about it. I listened to the podcast.
It was really interesting because, you know, I used an example of the conversation that the character of Christo has with Andrea in the book, the fight they have about writing about rage and beauty. And then he just laughed and he said, look, I have to, you know, I want to make it really clear to everyone that they are both me. You know, Andrea's, it's not a vote, exactly as you did. You know, it's not this character, it's not this friend, it's not this person. This is me exploring this idea for myself, and I am both those characters. So, you know, it was interesting.
Well, I'm the ghosts. Yeah. I mean, like the kind of arguments that Alice has with Leonard and Virginia, particularly with Virginia, like, are you calling me a lesbian? Why are you calling me a lesbian? Are you reducing me? What do you even mean when you use the word? Do you even understand what a threesome is? All those kind of things she asks. Arguments that I was with myself, like, how do I write about Virginia? How do I write about her sexual, complicated sexuality? How do I write about her past? And also with Leonard. Leonard was slightly more boring. And I kind of quite like making him someone who's so excited to have someone paying attention to him that he kind of started to tell his story and try and defend himself. That was kind of fun. But with Virginia, they really were discussions I was having in my own head. Because as I was reading about her, I just read so many different books with dramatic theories about why she was like the way she was. And I ended up sort of, there were some things that I discovered. I think about a million of us will have discovered these things if people have read all these books. Her death, for example, happened during World War II when the Germans were about to cross the Channel. They felt it seemed that the Germans were going to cross the Channel and that England was going to be invaded. And Leonard and therefore Virginia are Jewish people. They are expecting that they might be thrown into camps. There are trenches everywhere. It is winter. There are kind of planes going ahead. There are bombings. She is almost 60, about 60. She's sort of the age I am now, maybe a year older, or maybe two. She was not a young woman who was just being depressive. It was a very, everyone was discussing suicide, having discussions about how we're going to do it. Can we do it with cars? Should we buy cyanide? What are we going to do if the Germans get here? So there was so much obsession with psychoanalyzing her. Which is not, I mean, I have done analysis. I find it very interesting, but there was just not enough context, which was they're in the middle of a war. One of the other, I can't even remember now. There were lots of kind of little moments where I thought people just haven't actually recognised what was happening in people's day-to-day lives. Or another one actually being that any number of Leonard Woolf's friends and family committed suicide because that was people's response, I assume, to aged care and but getting depressed when you're really old. So like the times are different, that's what I'm saying.
Tell us about your kind of interest in your obsession with the archives for different reasons, but particularly for this devastating fever. And what was the genesis of this book that has been such a long time in the making and has come out in this kind of extraordinary, compelling form, which you didn't necessarily, I understand, intend it to be at the start. Where did it begin?
Well, it began because I was going to Sri Lanka. I got an AsiaLink fellowship and I was working on my second novel, Bird. And Michelle de Kretzer, who's a friend, said, you should read Leonard Woolf's diaries. He's written about Ceylon, well, as it was then. And so I read a whole lot of his work, including his first novel, A Village in the Jungle, but also his diaries and some of his early autobiographies. He wrote six autobiographies. And it was gripping. It was really amazing writing. And I was like, how come I didn't know this about this? You know, I only know him as Virginia Woolf's carer, someone that people are very critical of. And his observations were so modern, both about sexuality, but also about colonial politics. Now, I don't mean by that he was an impeccable human. He wasn't. He talked quite a lot about how damaged his sexuality was, partly because of the Victorian era and partly because of colonial times. But he had a kind of, I never say this word, perspicacity, is it? He can kind of see through situations, and that struck me. And I think I've said this in other interviews, but it was the moment that I thought there's a book in this. was when he talked about the day I heard of the shots ringing out in Sarajevo, I knew our world had changed, something like that, and which was basically the assassination of the Archduke that triggered World War One. And I'm researching this just after September 11, and that was my response to hearing about the Twin Towers coming down and my understanding that this was an attack. It was an attack on America rather than, because I must admit that when it first started happening, I just assumed it was some engineering disaster. It took me a while to quite realise what was going on. And I just remember thinking, oh, fuck, everything's it's going to get bad. It's going to get bad really quickly. And it did get pretty bad quickly for Muslim people as well. That sense of just knowing when you're in a historical moment, this is history. This history is happening to me. And I became more, as you would know from the in the contemporary scene, in this devastating fever, Alice walking to get her vaccination, her first vaccination, is that sense about realizing you're inside history. And that was my experience of the pandemic or being locked down, the pandemic still going, where you think the world will never be the same again. So the fact that he would made some of those observations was made me really interested in him. And then when I was struggling with the book after various iterations, I was reading his political work in the 30s, and the way he wrote about Mussolini and Hitler was so reminiscent, particularly of Trump, but the kind of political shifts which are still affecting us now. He was a really smart man. He wrote about pesticides, pesticide use, agriculture. He talked about the need for national parks. And so I just found myself, no matter as the years went by, as I got older, as my obsessions changed, there was always some observation that Leonard had to make that felt pertinent to me.
It feels like there was a trust. And when I've heard you speak about the process of writing it and at different times, a trust that the material had something to say and had would make itself into a shape that was right at a particular time. Did you ever feel like you were going to give it away?
No, and I did. Trust is probably too strong a word. It was more, but in that I did sometimes lose hope, and then I did write several books, and I did other work. I mean, I edited Me Angel. I did a huge amount of my life passed by with me doing other things, but I would always want to go back to it, and then I did. I just sort of applied to go and look at the archives in Lilly Library, the Bloomsbury Archives, at a point when I wasn't sure that I could keep going with the project. But then I got that fellowship and I went and spent 3 months, and the archives are extraordinary. The whole experience of being there was extraordinary. It was also strange because my biological father died the night I got there, which is kind of relevant to the project in that it was a melancholy, strange time reading all the letters and the testimonials of all these dead people at the same time as death was on my mind. So I think that sort of informed the kind of atmosphere of it. And the draft, that's when I started writing the voice that turned into Alice. But I gave people that version to read, and a couple of people, I gave it to 4 people to read, and everyone said it still needs a lot of work and it's not working. And there was a Sri Lankan character that I mentioned. She's redacted and when people said it's still not working, I must admit now, I was like, I just don't know that I can do this anymore, because I thought it was close. I can now see that it was. And then when the pandemic hit, I thought, here's another resonance, here's another thing. They went through the Spanish flu, which reminds me of what I was going to say about Virginia before. Another reason why she had poor health was she had had the Spanish flu and it had affected her heart. And so she did have heart problems, and cognitive function was an issue for people after the flu, as it can be after COVID. So, you know, there was contextual stuff. It wasn't just all about her. But once we started going through that, what we were going through, I thought, well, there's even more of a relationship. And also there's that Camus book, The Plague, where there's the author who rewrites the first page of his novel over and over, and then he gets COVID. Not COVID, plague. And I was like, this is me. Like, I'm going to be grand. I'm never going to finish the book. I'm going to get the book. I'm going to get the plague. I'm going to die. and the hysteria of those early days. And it was actually only when I reread The Plague during the play that I realised that he didn't die at all, so he still had time to finish his novel he wanted. But it was basically, I was like, well, I'm in lockdown. Clearly, we're all going to die, so what am I going to do? I'm going to finish that fucking book. That was kind of really when it just, and I just sat down and I just wrote.
In those years when you were doing, when you were not writing or finishing that novel, you were doing a hell of a lot of other things, and your range as a writer is incredibly expansive. Nonfiction, you know, your book about Cyclone Tracy, about Melbourne, which you've mentioned, picture books. But you mentioned to me that it was in your book of essays, City of Trees, that you found your voice. And we talked about the importance of voice earlier. So I wanted to know why that book, and how did you recognise that it was that kind of true voice coming through?
I'm going to answer that. And also just quickly on the Cyclone Tracy book, that's when I fell in love with archives, that book, and partly because of other people's voices. Archives are a place you go, and there's the letters, the testimonials. It's extraordinary how ordinary people speak and describe the world around them, and you know, the thing with the truth always being stranger than fiction, and you get that in archives. So that's sort of when that part of my seeing myself as a writer about pulling together words and rhythms and other voices became something I became really interested in. And then The City of Trees extended that, and it had more personal material in there than Cyclone Tracy. And it was in that Walking New York essay that won the Caliber Prize. I worked really hard on the essay, and when I'd done it, I thought, I found it. I just the people, and also the reaction to it, and the rhythms, and the way, I don't mean that I always use exactly the same voice, but I finally got what it was to write a piece with authentic voice, or with an original voice, or with, you know, my voice. And then I started seeking that level of kind of tried to do that in all my writing. And The City of Trees, I kind of, because that essay, that collection was, some of the essays were written as one-offs. And then when I realised I wanted to kind of gather them together, I then wrote several of the longer pieces to kind of draw the book together. And the essay, The Age of Loneliness, I think is probably possibly my favourite of those essays. And I'm just sort of really proud of the work that I did, and even though there are things I would change if I read, because the editing was a bit too fast. I wanted to get it out quickly, and I kind of wish I'd had more time with that book. But it was the moment where I sort of, that non-fiction voice gave me a sense of the strength of having a strong voice and what you can do with a voice. And also, I say this when I teach, but I feel quite like I do think that everything we need to be writers is in us, and we know what we want to say, and we have our approach to language and ideas, and it's partly just about having the courage to just do it and not to worry about what people think. So I used the phrase fuck it before, and I'm going to repeat it, because I do actually think it's an important thing. Like, you have to stop worrying about what other people think, and is this literary enough, or have I got, you know, you have to actually just have the courage of your convictions, and even if your voice is weird or unusual, or it's very plain, it's not writerly, or whatever it is that's your thing, or you're excessively, you know, elaborate and baroque, whatever you do, you just have to do it rather than trying to please people, because that's the only way you can, that kind of confidence, unless you bring that confidence to your work, you can't really find your voice. The example for this devastating fever was The Ghosts. So in the 2018 version, where people, other than one reader, people like, I just don't think you're Virginia in the library scene, or your ghost, there was less ghost in there. It's just not working. It's just too crazy. And I just remember thinking, after 6 months, I thought, I need more of it. That's the problem with that. And I just kind of let it rip. And so then it just started popping up everywhere, and all those kind of conversations in my head I'd had with characters, or arguments I'd had with myself about how I should approach the book, I just kind of allowed that to kind of enter, that kind of, that sort of, the haunted space in the contemporary material. And also it meant that I could the contemporary section actually has a lot of Leonard and Virginia in it. You know, it's a way of kind of connecting then and now. Anyway, it did lots of work, but that's an example of just actually, you just have to kind of, and I don't mean by any of that that you should never listen to editorial advice and that people are wrong, because they're not. If people have commented, there must be a problem. So if people didn't like the ghost, I wasn't doing it well enough, because some of those same people have read this latest version and they no longer have a problem with the ghost. So people are always right that there's an issue, but people are not always right, just as I was not always right as an editor, about the solution.
I love that. One of the things you mentioned earlier was being able to bring the very personal in with the historical moment. You talked about it with your journal. And one of the things that Bernadette Brennan said of you in City of Trees, she said, she wears her extensive research lightly and passionately explores her topics without veering into preaching. She muses on erasure, loss and grief, all on a personal, local and global scale. And I wondered if you thought that this is, in fact, the job of a nonfiction writer, or that perhaps your particular take on the role, to write and think from the and connect the personal to the global.
Yeah, totally. Because, I mean, who really cares about, you know, my grief or my sexual journey or my whatever it is? Like, you know, a few individuals might care, but no, you have to actually, I mean, so having talked about not caring what people think, I actually do feel very strongly that we need to try and connect with an audience, that writers, part of a writer's job is to kind of connect to other people. You're not just writing for yourself. You write the book, you kind of find the book by just writing for yourself, but then you do have to go back and think, so how, what's this going to be like for other people to read? And part of that is, and this actually relates to the time we're in at the moment, if you like, by which I mean climate change and, you know, potential for war popping up all over the place, those kind of things. Nothing is just personal. The personal is always political. And I kind of grew up thinking that, and I still think that. And things are only, I think we, or maybe it's me, people can be very self-absorbed, worrying about how things affect them. And it's only by actually thinking about how things affect everyone and the planet do those thoughts become more philosophical and useful or interesting. I mean, everyone, like the same ways you could write about the pandemic. If you're from Melbourne people, everyone in Melbourne had a bad time. No one in Melbourne did not have a bad time during the pandemic. Different reasons for different people. Some people got really sick. Some people lost loved ones. Some people had to homeschool. Some people just, like, lost their minds. You know, whatever. It was a terrible time. So given that it was a terrible time for everyone, there's no point really in dwelling on one's own particular, personally, very bad time. Partly because I didn't have to do homeschooling, just for starters. There are a whole lot of things that didn't happen to me, which doesn't mean to say I didn't find it traumatic. So it's about trying to encapsulate the broader trauma that people felt, and thinking about why was it so traumatic. Which I suppose, given that I had a pretty good run of it compared to a lot of people, and it was still traumatic, that was interesting. And that kind of, by interesting, I mean that the idea about living through history, and I found myself thinking about how ordinary and boring it is to, like, you know, we're in the beginning of, I'm going to make an incredibly dramatic statement, which actually might not be true. It was kind of like the beginning of the end of the Anthropocene. Where kind of the climate change is happening. We're in it. Things are going to keep getting bad. There's going to keep being flooding. There's going to keep being bushfires. There's going to keep being plagues. We've ended whatever this latest period, you know, the Industrial Revolution, as dramatic as the Industrial Revolution, which probably caused the problem we're in now. So it's dramatic as the, development of capitalism. I don't know enough. I haven't done economic theory, but it's like we are in one of those phases of history. And so trying to connect, understand, be able to see one's personal grief or whatever, one's personal feelings as being part of a broader system, make them, is interesting to me in a way that it's not, it really isn't interesting on a, you know, just minor unpleasantness or whatever. It's like irrelevant, really. And my big, so I'm just sort of talking on my rave now, but, and I know that you mentioned that you wanted to ask me about advocacy, but I did, after the bushfires, I just, which I actually think I'll probably end up crying. I basically can't even talk about that. I found that much more traumatic than lockdown. Lockdown was just longer and more exhausting. Mm. But, you know, but like the loss of so many of our forests, the loss of 3 billion Australian animals, Australia will never be the same again. This is where colonialism, this is where capitalism, this is where climate change has got us. And I thought, can I even continue to write, given that we're not in actual end times, but we're in the end of something. Something is ending times. So what can I do? And I decided that the only thing I actually am particularly good at, you know, is well, that I know well, is books and writing and the industry. So I thought, I'm not going to suddenly change, do something else totally other. But I do want my work to not, I don't want to shy away from what is happening. I want to, and I don't mean by that I want my book to be, my work to be miserable. I just mean that I think we have to look what's happening in the eye and then make decisions as a result. What do we do? What can we do to help? What can we do to change things? What do we do to protect ourselves? How do we bring up our children? But as I've got really intense as I'm being now about this subject, I think that's also allowed me to be funnier. Mm. I mean, like that's one of the reasons why maybe this devastating fear is funny, because geography does take itself very seriously. You know, Catherine takes her failed love affair very seriously, when really, I mean, who cares, whatever. Mm. She had some sexy times, like behaved badly at the end. Like, I think once you stop taking yourself seriously and thinking about bigger issues, you're kind of much freer to write in a different kind of way.
There's also different skills that you bring to this writing of now. One of the ones that I wanted to ask you about is your naming of things. I've noticed it in reading your essay and Living with the Anthropocene, and some of your work in Griffith Review and Meanjin. It's in City of Trees as well. This very specific naming sometimes is a litany of things lost. Like,
yes,
here are the trees that we've lost. Here are the birds, yes, that we've lost. And
that do that litany thing.
Yeah, quite a bit. It very much speaks to this idea of kind of look at this, pay attention. I want you to acknowledge that this is what's happening.
That's exactly what I'm trying to do. And also, I suppose, trying, like, I don't, like, we're probably going to lose all our trees by the middle of this century, not before. Dollar trees, I mean. I don't mean there might be street trees or any tree types, but, and I don't want that to happen without bearing some witness. I've chosen to, you know, pay attention to trees and some other things. Other people are writing about oceans or, you know, other things, class issues, whatever. You pick your battles and you pick what, I suppose, you have a strong connection with. So I partly want to just say this is what's important. This is what we can't afford to lose.
There's two other aspects of your process that you also write about. They are drawing and walking. I'll link to the Caliber essay. It's one of my very favourite pieces of writing, where you talk about walking, but I wanted to ask you about drawing and City of Trees and this kind of learning to draw. You wrote at one stage, I find that I often draw a tree before I write about it, that the drawing is akin to a meditation, an effective way to befriend the subject. Can you tell us just a little bit about that part of your process?
I think it was trying to stop my writing and myself probably being quite so heady. And always trying to kind of intellectualize or theorize situations and get back to an idea of just what is in the present now, what is happening, what is the case, what am I looking at, what am I feeling, what is going on for the planet, rather than always rushing through to either make pronouncements about what will happen in the future. You know, we're all going to die or it's all going to be fine, whatever. No one knows, actually. Writes a pronouncement, there's not a lot of point to them. And I have studied Buddhism in the past, and I think I'm sort of always aware of how much, well, I don't live as a Buddhist in a day-to-day sense. I do think it's very much informed that my sense about just trying to always be in the present, and drawing is very much a part of that. And when you're feeling a bit overwhelmed by anything, in a very enormous tree or whatever, like, what do I think about this? How can I look at this tree without thinking about, oh, it seems to have died back in its upper reaches? It's too tall to see the top of. it's the last tree left or the forest is gone. You know, the animals that used to kind of, you know, help pollinate it are becoming extinct, whatever. Like all the kind of, frankly, horrendous kind of thoughts that descend when one's trying to work, do environmental writing these days. It's really, it's a tough gig. Nice, you know, people like Tim Flannery and Joel Burgess and people who are really taking this stuff head on. I mean, it's just extraordinary that they manage. So how can I just actually just be in this moment with this tree? And drawing was my way into that. And also gave me a real sense of the patterns, the repetition of patterns you get in all plant life, actually. And I am interested in patterns and writing and pattern making. And it's just sort of amazing the way tiny little funguses can look like corals. Like, so, you know, you might, the repetition of patterns all through nature interests me. And just actually the reason why, even because I can get very speedy, it's just really a way of slowing myself down. Mm. I'm not good. I don't say that to be disingenuous. I say that because it's really, it's not why I do it. Mm. But I do it. It also does give me a different way to thinking about something. Walking does this as well, that you kind of think, I don't really know what to think or do or how to approach this. And then if I spend a day doing watercolours and just watching colour move over paper, I mean, sometimes I literally, it's kind of these crazy things I do, which are just basically just wetting the paper and letting the colour move through and watching this idea of, I really like watching how the painting emerge. You kind of like add water and colour and see what happens. Often what happens is it becomes a big brown mush of nothing, but sometimes it becomes more interesting. That kind of, and I kind of want to get that to that with my writing, where you kind of trust that you have it in you and that you just need to kind of let it out rather than, whether you call it super ego, whatever. You kind of actually want to find flow and process rather than arguing.
You've been involved in so many different aspects of the industry that, in fact, you've been granted an Order of Australia for your, and I quote, significant service to literature as an author, editor and role model. You've been editor of Mianjin, and you've co-founded the Stella Prize. You're now a board member of the ASA. I know that you've seen the best and worst, I imagine, of industry citizenship and support and behaviour over that time. And I want to ask, what do you want to see more of? And what do you want to see less of in the literary industry in the next kind of 5 to 10 years?
I'd like to see more funding. I would like there to be, in general, one of the upsetting things about, many upsetting things about the pandemic, but one of the upsetting things was that the way artists weren't properly supported. I know that there was a lot of talk about if you're a business and you could kind of get talked to an accountant. I mean, I realised that there were ways around that, but they were really quite challenging, and I'd say for, in, I won't get into the detail, it was very hard to access proper support. But in general, there's been a 40% drop in funding, I know, for the Australia Council for Literature, for funding grants for the writing of literature, for example. But money has dropped just across the board. In general, literature is just less and less respected and supported by governments, and possibly, I don't know that that is reflected in the broader culture. So I would, and I do know that there are countries where there is more respect for, when I say for literature, I just mean for books. I'm not talking about, these don't have to be highfalutin books. But France, Ireland, two countries that come to mind, Iceland, you know, books are a really important part of the culture. It would be good if we got remembered that. But how important story is. I mean, you mentioned Cloud Street. Cloud Street's been on my mind because it's the 40th year since its release, I think. But 40 years since Tim's been writing, or 40 years since Cloud Street. Either way, I've been asked a few questions about it, and he's been doing publicity about it. So that book, not only did it sell well, it's been, you know, it's been a play, it's been, there've been radio series. Has there been a television series? It's just like, it just has fueled our working culture and our ideas around story for decades. And yes, not everyone even loves it, and that's really beside the point. The point is it's become an iconic book, but there are lots of books that have become iconic books, and books are so important. So And that's not just really about the publishing industry. That's a kind of a more cultural shift. I think it's about a new form of conservatism. I think, you know, in the olden days, the Liberals might have been conservative in some ways, but supporting the arts was seen as important. And for some, you know, it's now, I think it's possibly about control. That is, by people not wanting to fund organisations or individuals unless you know exactly what they're going to do. So the ABC or individual artists. What if they say mean things about us? What are we just sort of fueling a kind of lefty view of the world or whatever people's anxiety? Whereas, say, with theatre with performing arts companies, you're funding an organisation, which feels like a safer thing to do than funding individual artists. So I would like to see that change. I do think also that writers probably need to be realistic about what support they can expect. A lot of people, there's a huge amount of stress in trying to make a living as a writer. And I think people need to just be aware that it might be that they, need a second string to their bow. And it might actually not necessarily be a great idea that that be within the literary industry. Mm. I told a few people this story when I did a writer's retreat with someone who made a living as a house painter. In some ways, that strikes me as a kind of like different headspace. You kind of do a job for 4 weeks, whatever.
Absolutely.
And then you kind of go back. And it kind of, so that kind of, I do think that funding is not the only answer. I do wish that publishing houses felt able to allocate more money to editing and design books. I mean, design sometimes given more money, but I do that the staffing of the publishing houses I feel has become more compromised over the years, and staff are paid poorly. Mm. Now the whole industry basically suffers from a lack of money. So books are worth more than people pay for them, and like I do get really very frustrated where people say I don't want to have to pay so much for books, or talk about parallel importation. So I understand some of the reasons for this. You know, you said in the question about some of the worst of things. But in the industry, it's actually an industry I feel very positive about in terms of the kind of people in the industry and the interactions that I have and continue to have. There's so many amazing people coming up as writers. And while individual writers, we can all be competitive with each other, or, you know, it's like everyone fighting for the pie and all that kind of stuff. There's also an incredible amount of support and generosity in my experience, and that's never changed. I've, you know, experienced since the late 80s. And I did find that the pandemic did make me realise that I felt like I had a place of work, and that place of work was the Australian literary community, even though I was in my house. And I found that it was fellow writers and friends that I was sending messages to and checking in on, in the way that people who maybe worked in an office but couldn't go to the office felt that. I do feel a kind of strong sense of community and connection, and that's, I find, actually quite powerful about the literary community.
There's a sense that you've been writing recently at this incredible and increasing pace, which could just be me, you know, paying attention, but perhaps you feel that too.
No, it's true. It is true.
And I wondered about the role that your kind of both climate anxiety and rage has played in this, and what you see your writing and advocacy work involving over the next little while.
Yeah, it's certainly the climate catastrophe is fueling. Like, I can't spend years writing books about trees. Like, my next book is about trees, and I'm actually in a bit of a state about how do I do that in a timely way, and how do I write it so it's just not endless doom and gloom and all these kind of issues. So that's part of the kind of increasing pace. And I also, and this is, it is because I'm turning 60, and I've, you know, both, like, I've had a lot of people dear to me be dead by the end of their 60s, let alone people have been dear to me who've died in their 50s, who are younger than me. The death of the writer Georgia Blaine really affected me. I loved her, but that's really, almost a bit above and beyond that fact, you know, just that sense of you don't actually even know how much time you have. And you see I'm getting teary. I can see myself as a problem with Zoom. And so it's partly like, this is what I do. I'm not going to change. I always used to think, for example, I might climb Mount Everest. I'm not even joking. Clearly, I'm not going to climb Mount Everest. You need to get a realistic sense about you have all these aims, things that you want to do, and at a certain point, you think, oh, I'm not going to do them, or maybe I'll do them, but really just trying to narrow my focus and do what I can do well better. And I actually think this is just a general life tip. I mean, I have a lot of, I understand where it emerges from, this sense of you've got to do all the things, like you've got to be good at as a playwright and then do your own screenplay and develop radio skills and whatever, because it's so hard to make a living as a writer. But I learning to say no and accept that, for example, I'm never going to be particularly good at screenplays. I've tried a couple of times. Maybe I could be good at them if I put a huge amount of effort into it, but I'm not going to put the effort into it. I'm going to stick to what I know how to do well. Maybe I, you know, in another life, I would have actually liked to be an artist rather than a writer. I'm not going to get the chance to do the put in the 10,000 hours or whatever the cliche is to become a great artist, which doesn't mean I won't keep doing art. But, you know, like you kind of just realise this is what I do, this is what I do well. And just also less, just a bit more settled. I mean, I think that when you're younger, you are trying to establish romantic life. You're trying to, you know, people having children, you're trying to work out who you are, and those things are all very time consuming. And then at a certain point you think, well, whatever I am, whatever is good or bad about what I am, kind of stuck with it now. So just stop worrying about any of that stuff and just kind of, you know, I'm just more disciplined, actually. That's a very long-winded answer. I've just developed a lot more discipline.
What would be the most frequent piece of writing advice that you give to your students or your colleagues?
Trust your voice. And you actually, and what I say most often when people say, what should I do about this or that, or is this or that working? I say, you know the answer. Mm. And people do know the answer. They may not be confident that they could possibly know the answer, but people know.
Sophie Cunningham, before I let you go, have you got a debut book, any time, any genre?
What I want to say is I actually love debut novels, full stop, and this is the truth. I do think there is a kind of energy and a voice that sometimes people can become more self-conscious over other books or have a more of an intellectual kind of purpose going in. But there's something raw about debut novels that I just love. My answer is I love debut books rather than I'm not going to call out anyone. Monkey Grip, stop. Okay, Monkey Grip made a big effect or had a big effect. There's a debut novel for you.
Nice. Thank you so much for speaking to me.
Oh, it's great. Thank you.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.